Deadline? What deadline? Healthcare is where we start today. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Tuesday, I believe it is, the 27th of June. Glad to have you along, as we always are. Everybody, two things about the healthcare bill that Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said today there is not going to be a vote on until after the 4th of July holiday. Thing one, have a look at the charts for the major stock indices today as that news came out. That drop you see right there, that is policy uncertainty made real, specifically tax policy uncertainty, because that is what the healthcare bill actually is, a tax bill. And Wall Street does like to know when tax cuts are coming. Thing two, the thing that arguably this whole rigmarole is about, making healthcare affordable, which politicians say is what they want to do all the time. But what, once you get past all the politicking, does that word even mean? From Washington, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams digs in.
Healthcare's not like housing, where you can punch a bunch of numbers into a calculator, and as long as you come up under a third of your income, that's generally affordable. Childcare, it's considered affordable at 7%. There is a threshold right now for healthcare, just under 10% of your income. Michael Darden is a healthcare economist at George Washington University.
The 10% has to cover 60% of the total cost of medical services for most people, and it's got to include most physician and inpatient hospital services.
That standard comes from Obamacare and is used to determine if an individual's costs, premium and out-of-pocket, are affordable. It doesn't necessarily reflect what people are able to pay, but the line had to be drawn somewhere. New York University's Sherry Gleed.
In order to be able to enforce an individual mandate, they had to say that if you couldn't afford to buy coverage, you were exempt from the mandate penalties.
Gleed says the current GOP bills don't have that mandate, so don't have an affordability standard. But you can't really set a firm number for when health care is and isn't affordable, says Elise Gould of the Economic Policy Institute.
What we know about healthcare spending is that it can happen at very unpredictable times, and many people don't spend anything for months at a time, and some people are going to have to spend a lot.
She says no matter what number you put on it, healthcare is only really affordable when paying for it allows you to afford everything else. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Elsewhere in global capitalism, this has been a very bad day in cybersecurity. A whole raft of companies, from the American law firm DLA Piper to the Danish shipping conglomerate Maersk to the Russian oil giant Rosneft, have been the victims of a massive ransomware attack. We got our senior tech correspondent Molly Wood on the phone to make me smart on all this. Hey, Molly.
Hey, Kai.
Give me the very quick ransomware explainer, would you?
Yes. Ransomware is a type of cyber attack where a hacker breaks into a network or a system, locks it down, encrypts all of it so that nobody can get in, and then asks for money before they'll unlock it.
So now these companies have to deal with getting back control of their data. It doesn't seem like there's a rhyme or reason to the kinds of companies that are out there getting hit by this.
Yeah. I mean, I think the rhyme or reason seems to be companies that have vulnerable networks. What we're hearing is that the tools that are being used in this today's attack are similar to, they're using the same exploits that were used in the most recent, the ransomware attack that was called WannaCry, that was primarily confined to the UK. And, you know, look, this is the kind of thing that security researchers have been talking about for years, if not decades, which is that companies, utilities, banks, even governments, maybe even especially governments, are not ready. They are not prepared for this sort of next generation of hacking tools that at this point, thanks to that big theft from the NSA, are freely available online. I mean, the hackers who broke into the NSA and stole their collection of hacking tools are essentially offering them up as like a wine of the month club.
Good line. And am I wrong if I say that this is becoming increasingly worrying?
that would be a nice calming way to put it. Yeah, I mean, I think for a lot of security researchers, you know, the sense is that the worst case scenario is here. It points to a lot of different things that are troubling. One is spy agencies are stockpiling tools that can be used to break into systems, and those tools can be stolen and put into the wild. And we don't know what's happening on the networks that are currently locked down. I mean, the hackers could be using the ransom demands as a cover to be stealing all kinds of other things and set up for the next attack. So, it's worrying. It's troublesome.
Let me change gears on you here real quick and ask you about this Google fine from the European Commission this morning. $2.7 billion, as we've all heard. Interesting, isn't it, that the European Union's the one going after American companies for monopolistic and anti-competitive practices and not American regulators, huh?
Yeah, it's definitely not the first time, and it's sort of a growing trend. And people watching the tech industry have been asking for a long time, is this going to cross the pond? Is this kind of zeal for, you know, prosecuting these anti-competitive or antitrust behaviors going to come to the U.S.? And I think that's, you know, that's the real question, and that's probably the only point at which you would see real change from these companies. But yeah, European regulators, I think, have said very clearly some of it is that these are big American companies who are coming in and trampling all over small European companies, unquestionably. And they have said, we don't think these companies have the right to behave however they want in service of making money. That is not usually a line that U.S. regulators take.
Molly Wood, she is our senior tech correspondent. I should tell you, we talk about all of this stuff, actually, on the new episode of our podcast. It's called Make Me Smart. It dropped today. You can get it at Apple Podcasts. You can get it at marketplace.org/makemesmart. And it's me and Molly talking about a bunch of stuff. Molly, thanks a lot.
Yeah. Thanks, Kai.
On Wall Street today, as I said, do not mess with Wall Street and tax cuts, yo. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The rise of ride-sharing apps has not been kind to old-school rental car companies because really, who wants to pay for a car and some parking when a couple of rides might be cheaper, yeah? This week, though, some of those rental companies are getting a lift from technology firms. Google's Waymo has a deal with Avis to manage a fleet of self-driving minivans out in Phoenix. Apple is going to test its own driverless technology on cars, at least from Hertz. Marketplace's Amy Scott has that story.
You know what tech companies do really well?
Replace tires, do oil changes, recharge vehicles if they're plug-ins.
Yeah, not so much. Analyst Sam Abu El Samad with Navigant Research says rental car companies, on the other hand, do exactly that for millions of vehicles in locations all over the world. So as Apple and Google parent Alphabet develop autonomous cars,
it makes sense that they would need somebody to partner with to maintain their fleets of vehicles. And the rental car companies are already well positioned to do that.
Then again, we're not talking about your average Nissan Altima. Stephen Bayless is with the Intelligent Transportation Society of America, which advocates for driverless cars. Both Google and Apple are members. He says self-driving cars are highly advanced with all kinds of fancy sensors that need to be maintained.
I think it'll be a learning process for both the tech giants and also, I think, for the rental car companies.
Hertz, by the way, wouldn't comment on the deal reported by Bloomberg, and Apple didn't respond. But what might be in this kind of partnership for rental car companies? If nothing else, a new revenue stream at a time when services like Uber and Lyft are taking a growing bite out of their business. Richard Wallace is with the Center for Automotive Research.
They must be making money off of it or they wouldn't have signed the deal. So, you know, even if you're just paying me to do oil changes times some number of vehicles, hey, that's good business.
Even better, these older transportation companies get in on what may be the future of driving. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
You know how New Yorkers like to say it's the greatest city in the world? Well, not so fast, huh? Because have you seen the New York City subway lately? It's a mess. Most recently this morning, 34 people were hurt after an A train in Harlem derailed inside a tunnel, leaving passengers to walk 200 feet through the dark and the smoke and the rats to get out. Delays, as you might imagine, spread through the whole system, which on the one hand is news. To New Yorkers, though, Tuesday. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore reports the transit system in the biggest city in the country has more problems than it can handle and not nearly enough money.
Ask a New Yorker how they feel about the subway.
Subway travel is a struggle. There are always delays.
Delays, they're repairing.
Oh, I would definitely give it C minus.
The weekends, an F.
Stephen Gard, Maria Dana, Brendan Tormey, Mikey Dallas, all among the 6 million commuters that ride the subway each day. Consistent, unpredictable, maddening subway delays have real economic consequences. Mikey Dallas got a job in Williamsburg, and then his subway stop was shut down for construction.
Yeah, because of that, I had to eventually leave the job because I wasn't able to make it to work.
In 2012, there were about 28,000 delays a month. Today, there are there are more than 70,000 delays. The system has two basic problems. One, it's 113 years old.
We are trying to run a 21st century global capital using 1930s technology.
John Raskin directs the Riders Alliance. The rail cars and signal systems need replacing. There's still damage from Hurricane Sandy, plus a new tunnel to build and lines to extend. And the subway is so constantly in use that there's no good time of day or night to shut it down and fix it. Problem two, money. New York State put funding on autopilot for generations. Veronica Vanterpool runs the Tri-State Transportation Campaign.
A lot of those funding streams or the portions of fees and taxes that make up those funding streams have not changed over many years.
She says the subway system could need $20 to $35 billion more than it's getting in the next 5 years. New York State just hasn't figured out how to come up with the money for a subway system that supports 10% of the country's GDP. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
Today's North American Free Trade Agreement word of the day is maquilas. Maquilas. American-owned factories that line the Mexican side of our common southern border. Those manufacturers have been bracing for and to some degree embracing the much-promised renegotiation of NAFTA that President Trump campaigned on. It's not like they want tariffs to come back, but they do maintain that NAFTA as it stands now makes operating in Mexico a lot harder than it needs to be, thanks in large part to time-consuming, bottom-line-draining paperwork. Lauren Madelon reports from the maquila city of Reynosa across the Rio Grande from McAllen, Texas.
The threat to change NAFTA, maybe even end it. You'd think managers of maquilas might worry. Not the case. They see an opportunity.
NAFTA's 30 years old. It hasn't kept up with today's economy.
That's Mike Myers, a Texan who heads a maquila owned by Metal Industries, a Florida company that makes vents for air conditioners and heating systems.
We paint it, pack it, and ship it.
Maquilas are foreign-owned factories in Mexico, the majority American, that produce goods for export. They sprang up like mushrooms after the rain when NAFTA took effect in 1994. Maquilas leverage low labor costs in Mexico and duty-free access to the U.S. market, producing everything from televisions to medical equipment to computer parts.
All our consumer products are being touched in Reynosa and then shipped back to the United States because of geography.
Rhetoric around a border tax has cooled lately. House Speaker Paul Ryan said the idea where duties would be placed on U.S. imports lacks support. Mike Myers doesn't want to see a border tax. But as for NAFTA itself, that's a different story.
Again, it was negotiated with different sets of rules on both sides of the border. We have to spend a lot of time and effort making sure we're 100% compliant with the Mexican government in order to be compliant with NAFTA.
He's talking about a mountain of paperwork, a lot of it on actual paper. He has to show Mexico that all raw material he brings in from the U.S., steel, aluminum, leaves Mexico as finished product. That's how he gets duty-free access to both markets under NAFTA. But he says the paperwork Mexico demands from maquilas to prove they're meeting that threshold is intense, far more than what the U.S. asks for to show NAFTA compliance when his finished goods are shipped north.
If we're renegotiating a treaty, we ought to try and simplify things like that.
Maquilas matter for both countries. Americans pay far less for products they buy, while maquilas are one of the few sectors that consistently generate jobs in Mexico. Economist Cesar Hernandez says that if conflicting rules can't be resolved, or if NAFTA negotiations go badly, U.S.-owned factories in Mexico will have options.
Mexico has trade agreements with European Union, with most of South America, with Japan, with Israel. So in that sense, Mexico is very well positioned.
There are other NAFTA details maquila owners want changed. Keith Patridge is CEO at McAllen Development Corporation. That's a group that promotes the interests of American-owned maquilas.
Right now, the CBP, Customs and Border Protection, hours of operation for trucks does not match the hours of operation for the Mexico aduana.
Aduana, Mexican Customs. Patridge says different hours translate into lost revenue.
Companies are more and more looking at really fast turnaround and delivery, and logistics is the name of the game.
Something else on Patridge's wish list. The digital age was in its nascent stage when NAFTA took effect. Patridge and the Maquilas want an updated NAFTA to scrap paper certification in favor of all digital documentation. In Reynosa, Mexico, I'm Lorne Madelon for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So there was just a great fear of automation.
Bank tellers face their computerized counterparts, but first, sure, why not? Let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is off 98 points today, 0.4%, 21,310. NASDAQ off an even 100 points. The century mark, 1.6%, 6146. S&P 500 off 19, 0.8%, 24.19 there. As Molly and I talked about, the EU fined Google a record $2.7 billion for favoring its own shopping service in search results. Google parent Alphabet off 2.6% today. Merck hit by that ransomware attack, down about a 0.5%. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note, it was up 2.20%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. There was a study out this week from the University of Washington and the National Bureau of Economic Research that is raising some questions about how people might want to think about minimum wage in this country, specifically increases thereto. Mark Long is a professor of public policy at UW. He's also the co-author of the paper in question. Thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you very much for having me.
What was it that you found exactly in this study?
We were looking at what happened in Seattle when it raised its minimum wage from $9.47 an hour, which was the state's minimum wage, up to $13 an hour. What we found is that in exchange, that hours were reduced by about 9%. As a result of that combination, we found that earnings were reduced for these low-wage jobs.
So employers, realizing they were going to have to pay more per hour, cut people's hours.
That is what it appears to be.
If you separate out higher income wage earners in the Seattle area, the folks in the high tech companies, and you go to the restaurant workers and the ticket takers in the movies and more low wage service kinds of jobs, where do you see the impact of the wage decreases the greatest?
Yeah, so Seattle is a booming economy, and you're right, it's actually helping the affluent very well in this city. And so as a result, if you look at the restaurant industry as a whole, which has been what a lot of other studies have done, you find no effect. And we also find no effect for the restaurant industry as a whole. But when you separately look at low-skill jobs, whether it be in the restaurant industry or another industry, that's where you're seeing the reduction in employment opportunities.
What are you seeing out of people, activists across the country, who are driving for a $15 minimum wage, who say this is the way to get working people in this economy a living wage, and they look at your study and they go, wait, what?
Well, I think there's two things you should take away from this. One is there should be some concern about the disemployment effects, particularly of local minimum wages, in particular when it's a large increase in the minimum wage.
Disemployment
However,
effects are?
A reduction in the job opportunities, okay. The jobs and the hours available.
Okay.
But the other thing you should be thinking about is what are the distributional effects? And that's one of the things we plan to study. So, for example, is this causing a reduction in opportunities for teenagers while at the same time promoting the opportunities for low-wage heads of households? And if that is the case, it may be worth it, the trade-off between promoting the living wage opportunities for working adults who have children in exchange for reduction in teenage job opportunities.
If I'm a labor activist in Sheboygan or New York City or Portland, Maine, what do I take from this?
Well, you should take, of course, this is one study and it's in one area. And so you should be concerned whether what we're finding is a particular artifact of it being Seattle. I think they have a strong belief that this is a way to improve the lives of low-skill workers and their families. But that said, they should be tempered by some of this evidence in their enthusiasm, particularly when they're talking about local minimum wages. Again, a state or a federal effort is likely to have a different effect.
Mark Long, his professor of public policy and governance at the University of Washington. Professor, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you've got a story about living on minimum wage, Lizzie O'Leary and the crew over at Marketplace Weekend want to hear from you. There's a link where you can do that at marketplace.org. It's over on the left-hand side of that page. There are plus or minus 3 million ATMs out there in the global banking industry, a technology that, by the by, turns 50 years old today, 50. Back then, banks were open 9 to 3, maybe, and closed on Sundays. If you wanted cash for a trip or some weekend shopping, maybe you had to get it ahead of time. And, oh, yeah, you had to interact with a human being while you were doing it. My, how times change, huh? Marketplace's Mariel Segarra has that story.
From the entrance of Chase's World Trade Center bank branch in Manhattan, you can't see the teller windows. They're tucked around a corner, sometimes covered up by a remote-controlled curtain. Instead, you're greeted by a row of ATMs. Weston Guy is the branch manager.
This is the branch of the future.
The ATM screens look like really big iPads standing upright on kiosks that are lit up in blue. And they let you do things a lot of other ATMs don't. Pay your credit card bill, get $5 bills, withdraw several $1,000s.
So this is just like using the teller. You don't have to use a teller anymore. You could just use this to do everything.
The first ATM wasn't quite so sophisticated. On June 27th, 1967, in a suburb of London, Barclays Bank installed a machine that allowed customers to withdraw cash using paper vouchers. The British press called it the robot cashier. Soon, other banks in the UK and Sweden came out with their own machines. A lot of bank tellers despised them. Tom Harper, the founder of the ATM Industry Association, says Barclays' early machines were often sabotaged.
They found out that the tellers were sneaking outside and pouring honey on the keyboard so that it was unusable, so people would come in and find a use for the tellers. So that there was just a great fear of automation.
Those tellers didn't have much to worry about. The machines were not user-friendly. Bernardo Batiste Lasso teaches business history at Bangor University in Wales.
They were very fragile. So if one component didn't work, the whole machine shut down.
It took a while for the technology to mature. Once it did, ATMs started springing up everywhere. In 1980, there were about 54,000 of them globally. By 2000, there were more than a million.
It's like a bank that never closes. It makes your life a little easier.
Barbara Kahn, who teaches marketing at the Wharton School, says self-service wasn't a new concept. Gas stations had self-service pumps, and for decades there had been these cafes called automats.
You could put coins in a little machine and out would pop your sandwich.
Were the sandwiches any good?
No, they were terrible.
ATMs went a step further. They upended a central relationship in people's lives, the one they had with their banks. Kahn says banking had always been personal. You knew your tellers and your branch manager.
And banks used to encourage that. They used to give you toasters and have all sorts of fun things for you to do in the bank if you would open new accounts. It was a social activity.
ATMs changed that dynamic, and they laid the groundwork for banking away from the bank, on the phone, online, and ultimately on your smartphone. So what happened to the bank tellers? Between 1970 and 2010, banks were building a lot of new branches, and the total number of tellers in the U.S. doubled. But there were fewer people working at every branch. And now, because of mobile banking and new ATMs, more than 100,000 teller jobs have been lost in the past decade, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Lewis Hyman, who teaches financial history at Cornell, says it's a familiar story.
Automation will replace and has replaced historically any kind of routine job.
Hyman says the idea in the long run is that machines will free humans from repetitive work like cashing checks and counting bills. As for the robot cashiers, they're still changing. Banks are testing next-generation ATMs that you can operate with your fingerprint, your mobile phone, and even a scan of your eyeball. In New York, I'm Mariel Segarra for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, the quote of the day, and some darn fine advice, really. It comes to us from German Chancellor Angela Merkel, who was speaking yesterday ahead of the G20 meeting she's going to host in a couple of weeks. She was asked at one point about President Trump and his Twitter habit, and she said she doesn't have a Twitter account, but she said basically that's what Google's for. This is a quote. "I just take a peek every once in a while," she said. "I put in Twitter and Trump, and then I've got everything I need." Words to live by, am I right? All right, we're done. The Dow off 98 today, 0.4%. NASDAQ dropped 100 points on the nose, 1.6% there. S&P 500, 19 points to the downside, 0.8%. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. Our digital team includes Ben Hethcote, Sarah Menendez, Donna Tam, and Tony Wagner. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.